I may need some drink because I have a sore throat. So today is the last lecture from my side, and I'm going to wrap up what we started in terms of especially more about data analysis, machine learning, and impact on different applications. And then, so today is largely about, so let's just go. Oh, this doesn't seem to, oh. Okay, that's the problem. Yeah, today, so the last lectures, what we covered was essentially, I tried to give you an idea of what are the kinds of things going on in computer science, the whole idea of the availability of large amount of data and a lot of intelligent algorithms and a whole range of technologies that allows you to effectively integrate computers into your day-to-day life. Then I went into a little bit about Google and PageRank and some idea of data structures and graphs. Then we went into a bit more details on image processing and deep learning, and to give you a flavor of what's going on there. And the last lecture was about the fact that, okay, yes, there are algorithms, but when we are trying to build more complex systems, you need actually a structure, organization, and essentially you need to then think about how people can be integrated into the development process in a proper way to build artifacts for society. So that was actually the last class. So today I try to wrap up this whole discussion and try to give you a broader picture beyond image analysis and to really focus on, you know, when you talk about data science, big data, and there's all these buzzwords, what essentially is going on, and what essentially is the, from the point of view of computer science and programming, what are the tools available for doing such distributed large-scale data analytics. The actual programming part of it is going to be small, because I think that you already have knowledge of Python, and there's so many tools available, and there is a whole platform available for big data analysis called Pandas. That essentially is what you would use. And actually, the details of this thing is not so difficult, except that it's a lot of practice that you have to do. So what I'll try to do essentially is highlight the kinds of what essentially is data analysis, what is different in data analysis now from before, and what essentially, to give you an intuition for what essentially can you do with data. And in terms of what kind of inferences you can draw from data. Yeah. And this actually is a much more harder question, because you know you can actually collect a lot of data, but then to draw conclusions from the data, one has to have a knowledge about the domain and the kinds of questions you may want to ask, and then you have to have knowledge about statistics, and then appropriately you have computer science knowledge to be able to build programs and test them. So this is basically a broad range of things that you need to know in order to be a data analysis person. And so this class is mainly about introducing you to what is going on in data analysis and the flavor of what has been achieved using large data in the since 2010, for example. And then go one concrete example on data analysis using, let's say, time series. So the talk would go like this: why do you need data science? What kind of data source types exist? What about quality of data? This is an important element because you know you're taking different types of data sets and then you're trying to combine them and then make actually a database or an organized structure. And in that process of even organizing, you have all kinds of errors. And therefore, you conclusions that you draw from wrong data would be, and missing data would be obviously erroneous if you are not careful about the quality. Then I would go into very specifically data analysis example. So let's just go back. By the way, the The credit for the slides here, I actually tend to use some of the best courses from outside and adapt it to my style. For instance, this is actually one of a well-known Berkeley professor in robotics that I know from a long time, and his sources. And so I adapted those sources to give you my perspective on top. Okay. So what essentially is data analysis? If you look at it, data analysis has been around for years. So if you go back to the 1930s, okay, and this is one of the early pioneers in statistics, basically Fisher, who actually had a paper called Design of Experiments. There in the 1930s, what you were talking about essentially is you were trying to do very specific set of experiments. Data collection was hard. You had to actually, for example, imagine you're a farmer trying to improve the yield of a crop, and you have different types of treatments of soil, and then you want to understand which treatment of soil actually tends to give you better results for particular kinds of crops. So in that sense, basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to actually do field experiments where you go in and think about organizing your plot into parts, and then in each of these plots you do different experiments, and then you collect data from that, and then you analyze it. Okay, so that's kind of the classic way you think about statisticians' work, where you have a very well-defined hypothesis, or at least you have a clue of a hypothesis of what you want to check, what is the answer you want to derive, and or conclusions you want to draw, and then you go and do an experiment. You collect data very specifically for that experiment, and then you bring it to the lab or wherever, and then you analyze it. So that's basically the classic way data analysis was going on. Now, this, of course, was applied, the same statistics principles were applied in the area of quality control. So in manufacturing, when you actually have a batch of parts, and then you want to obviously not inspect every part, but you want to get an idea of how the batch performed in a process. Then the idea of sampling, essentially some subset of the parts, and then doing the analysis on the subset, and then from there you can extrapolate and draw conclusion on what the whole batch might have done. So that's kind of the classic statistics approach to data analysis. So this has been around, so 1935, 37, 39, applying in business, and then you have this classic statistics book, data analysis in 1977, and then how it is applied to business, maybe later. And then you had actually the Google and the machine learning and basically scientific data analysis, this Microsoft. And then, again, the Google's idea of, hey, you don't really worry about going and collecting very specific, systematically, very specific data sets for specific problems. But what if you had a large amount of data? Can you directly draw conclusions from this large amount of data? And in fact, Google's approach is very much saying, look, first you should actually collect large amount of data, use machine learning type ideas to fit models, and then use simple models, get actually most of the answer from there, and then improve. Okay, so that's basically a different paradigm. It doesn't involve experts in the early on, and basically assumes that data is actually can be collected and organized, and then you basically have computers which actually just bring it together, and then we have tools for analyzing it. So in that sense, machine learning is really more data-driven, whereas if you think about classical statistics, you can call it model-driven, where you have a model hypothesis. Then I remember my slides were saying, okay, until 2010, there was actually this big data, deluge, and people are talking about how we are overwhelmed with data and we have to analyze data. So this gives you an idea of, okay, yes, data analysis has been around. And what kind of conclusions can you draw from data, right? So here is, for example, a scenario where as early as 1925, you have a degenerate heart disease data, and this is the number of deaths per 1,000, and this is the percentage of fat that you're ingesting as a total of your what you're eating. So if you notice it, you can see if the percentage of fat is lower, then it seems like your deaths for heart disease is lower, whereas if you're eating a lot of fat, you have much more. And it's clear from here, okay, look, these are the samples from different countries and how even their styles of eating perhaps is, and essentially their proclivity for disease. So this data tells you a story, yes. Yeah? And so it says, okay, there's a correlation, or let's say there's a correspondence between the amount of fat consumption and heart disease. And so what essentially happened in around 2010, 2012 actually, is that Google also had this claim that, oh, look, I can actually take a lot of data from the web, and I can already predict how viruses propagate and so on, and I can tell you outbreak of disease up front. Okay. And in fact, there was a big science paper which actually talked about how this happened and how we can beat the best statistical models that are put out by the Center for Disease Control. We'll come to that later. The point is that actually they did show that they could predict in the near term what will happen. But the reality is that if you're not careful about the data analysis, and if you're not careful about understanding the data was acquired in a particular context, reapplying it in a new context may be actually different. It may not give you the right answers. And in fact, that's what happened to the same software, and Google had to retract this claim later. So, but the point is that, you know, there is indeed real usage of the stuff, right? And I think you may all may have heard about this, which is that there was a person, Nate Silver, who essentially was able to forecast, you know, the election in 2012 by, again, using data and doing a data-driven approach to essentially prediction of elections. And he essentially, so in that sense, you know, and in fact, what the main idea there was that, in fact, what was happening was that data was used in many ways to actually shape and understand the landscape of the electorate in order for you to actually make a change. For example, Obama was able to construct with behavioral scientists a very good database, and then he's going to be able to use the database to say who are the new kinds of people who are voting, and then be able to influence this whole thing through IT. Okay, so elections are nowadays shaped by IT technologies and data analysis. So, and the key point that you have to understand is, I don't expect you to read this, but the key point that you have to make is that whatever conclusions you make from data, you have to be careful about what conclusions you draw, because it all depends upon how the data was acquired, what was the context in which you sampled the data, and then what variables and factors will influence the data collection. And then after that, you can talk about what kind of conclusions you can draw, in what time frame. Yeah? Can you extrapolate for a long time, or short term, and so on. So you have to be careful about this, because essentially, there was a paper which actually from Princeton, which said, hey, look, we could use the models of disease propagation, and we could extrapolate that for predicting how Facebook will behave, or how many people would actually continue to adopt Facebook. In fact, they predicted that Facebook was going to have actually a big dip in usage. Yeah? And that essentially showed, for example, they fitted a model to MySpace data, search data, and then said, okay, look, this is our model. This looks like it's fitting well. I extrapolate it for Facebook, and then I predict, for example, that, hey, you should see a dip in the Facebook usage. This clearly is actually a conclusion that you cannot draw that easily and transfer over. So this is why data analysis is complicated. You have to really be careful about what conclusions you draw from data. And essentially, in fact, there are some other people who had a parody in a sense. They looked at actually Princeton like data in Facebook and then showed that, for example, likes, the number of likes go down over time. So basically the idea is that Princeton will have no students at all by 2021. So again, the point I try to make here is that you have to be, data analysis are complicated. Data analysis and conclusions you draw from data essentially depend upon a lot of factors, and you need actually proper statistical training and proper understanding of the whole process and how data comes together to make conclusions. So this is why there's actually a whole master's program in data science. Okay. So, what we do know now essentially is that we have lots of sources of data, right? So you can get data from any online transaction. You can get data from the web, the mobile, YouTube, the Facebook, and the Twitter, and so on. Then you can get actually data from machine to machine, the whole automation world. the Internet of Things. And then you essentially can take data from healthcare, health, and also from scientific computing. When you talk about, for example, there is a professor who's going to follow up after me, who works on the data from CERN, which is basically from physics experiments of particle accelerators data. And that's large data, and analyzing that data and then extracting particle tracks and so on. Yeah. So basically you have, these are the kinds of large amount of sources that are available, and you need tools for processing them. And of course you saw the graph data structures and networks in the first class. And so effectively you can get the picture. The picture is that there is basically large amount of data. And what you have to get from the first part of the talk is you can't essentially be careful about what conclusions you draw from data, and it all depends. Essentially depends on how the data collection is done, what kind of experimental methodology you want to use to verify your claim, and there are some rigorous ways to check whether data conclusions you draw are correct or not. So what is data science? If you go to any, there's basically a whole range of competitions that are there these days. What's called Kaggle website, if you go to kaggle.com, you'll find out that there is all kinds of data competitions. Okay, for example, do the flight optimization for me, or forecasting a flu, dogs versus cats is a fancy machine learning problem, where you have pictures of dogs and pictures of cats, and you want to build a machine learning system that will classify dogs versus cats. And people go and then try their machine learning algorithm, and then they submit their algorithm and say, okay, I do this much performance. And so this is basically happening as we speak. And this has been going on since 2011 or 12. Now, so what do you really need to do data science? Yeah? So what you really need to do for data science is you need actually these type of, all this knowledge. In fact, you see, you need hacking skills. What do I mean by hacking skills? You need to be good with computers, different tools, programming, and the ability to glue things together, to pull together different types of information, and then do the analysis. So that's actually related to this class. And then you need actually understanding of actually statistical modeling and fitting. So in fact, math, applied mathematics and statistics is the core of this, and machine learning is an intersection between hacking and essentially applied mathematics and statistics. And then there is the expertise, yeah, where you can have essentially domain knowledge of what exactly you're trying to look for. And therefore, you can actually appropriately ask the right kind of questions. Okay. So you need a domain expert, you need a computing guy, and you need essentially math and statistics knowledge to do the stuff. Yeah? And in fact, these three elements are, ideally, if it can be brought into one, it basically makes it more efficient. So what's the difference between the old way of doing data analysis and the current way of data analysis? So I already alluded to this point in the first part of, in the early part, that in the past, the data was actually purposively collected for a reason. So you had a particular reason why you collect the data, you had a scientific hypothesis, or you had some inkling of what its use could be, and you wanted to understand some trend, and then you go and data, collect data, you use models to fit to data. Whereas more now, I can actually go and take pictures of him and put it up on the web. Hopefully not, okay? But I can, so essentially you have all kinds of data that's collected, and essentially you're able to pull it up, right? Put it up. So in that sense, what's going on is that data seems to be cheap. Cheap in some sense. Yes, of course, it looks like I can collect it and I can use a networking infrastructure and I can actually put it up in the web. The memory is cheap. I can have all the stuff go into some common repository. But the question that you can ask then is there any organization in this data? Okay. What kind of conclusions do I draw? So if you go to any company, they'll say, oh, I have lots of data. I produce lots of data. Then the magic is, oh, you know, you can have all the data, you somehow stream it and put it into some form. Now I could actually try to go in and analyze it after the fact, even without knowing what you collected the data for in the beginning. That's kind of the statement that's being made in the, let's say at least this is the trend, right? So in that sense, what you're thinking about is saying, hey, I have a lot of data, I need to have tools that will monetize the data, or at least it will try to infer certain properties from the data in your domain, and essentially you don't really collect it with a particular purpose, so you have to be careful about what kind of conclusions you can draw, so that's why you need training. But on the other hand, data is cheap. And whereas in the older database king, you have data which is precious, the volume is modest, here it's massive, and the example is that you have bank records, personal records, and so on. This is basically classically, you know, things like the census and medical records, which are all structured, right? And then you can talk about, in fact, you want these data to be, the integrity of the data to be certified, meaning that you want to make sure software is actually reliably changing things and the data is actually of high quality. So in that sense, there are certain priorities on the software, the database side, and then you have a structured model of the data, and then you have particular transactions, and you had what's called SQL, which allows you to query and access the data. On the other hand, in the data science world, you have actually a variety of sources of data. You have you need to address the issue of computational speed, the availability, and the ability to query for many different things. You don't really know the answer up front. And essentially, you have weakly structured and sometimes unstructured data. So I had a colleague who essentially was looking at in the late 90s, for instance, doctor's notes, and then being able to scan it and then be able to import it. And then it's kind of unstructured. You can have errors in the scanning, and then but still that data goes into a text file, and then you analyze it along with the healthcare the imaging data sets. So so you got an idea of what it is, and then the representations that you use, here is actually a regular database. Here it could be no SQL, so there's no even structure in the table. Okay, so effectively in the databases, you're talking about querying the past data with the structured mind. In data sciences, you're talking about querying the future. And you can talk about how it applies to business, and there are lots of books that were written up in the early 2010s. Now, what's the difference between the classic way of doing data analysis and what is going on now? The classic way of doing data analysis, for example, for doing climate models, used actually knowledge about the physics, knowledge about the problem, and it's much more precise, and it ran on a supercomputing cluster. And that's the classic way of doing it. The more modern way of doing it is I give an image, I have a general purpose tool, this is basically what we talked about, deep learning, whatever, and then you essentially put out an answer. Okay. So in this case, you have more generic tools, presumably widely applicable. You check out all the data, how it worked, and then you said, okay, I accept the result because I know this is how much performance I get on this large data set. Okay? So that's the difference between the two. And then, of course, you have cloud computing that you have now to be able to run these things on cloud. And the typical process that you go through these days is that you have actually a data collection process. You have to clean it and prepare it so that you get it in some format. And then you hypothesize a model, and then you evaluate it, interpret it, and then you go through this. This is really the typical loop of exploring the models that are fitting the data and then moving around. And then you can apply it and make conclusions on a larger scale. Okay? So far, it's basically now what I've told you is about an overview of data analysis, data science. Now, what essentially is, let's say, the specific steps? And what are the challenges? So we'll talk about the hacking skills first. So the big picture is that you have different types of data sources. You have to essentially extract, transform, and load it into some sort of a sink, a data representation. And then you're able to actually produce a whole range of assessments on the data. That's basically the big picture. But the problem essentially is that this is quite unstructured. So you need to have a process by which this is moved into some sort of semi-structured form. So this is typically what goes on in the data preparation stage. So in the data preparation stage, what you're saying is, okay, extract the data from the sources, source or sources. You need to load the data into the sink. So when I say sink, it's basically any of these programs which analyze do data, for example, a Python-based machine learning program, or an R, which is a statistical package, and so on, and maybe a database store. And then the sources could be a certain type of organized data sets, files, event logs, websites, and so on. And then you need to transform the data at the source and then sync or in a staging area. This is basically what you're doing. And basically, you have a notion of data characterization, data cleaning, data integration, which is essentially a way of trying to organize your data sets so that you can actually do analysis that's required. And in fact, in order to do this efficiently, what you need essentially is you need to be able to think about real-time, think about efficient algorithms. Okay, so data transfer is an important issue. And for example, compression might be important, and then how you serialize and deserialize may be important. And so, for example, the workflow might be like, okay, take the data set file, then run it through a word count, and then you run it through a mailer, for example. It's a very simple script. That script already does something to get you a data stream. And essentially, if you want to use it many times, you have to use multiple scripts, of course. And you can actually record the execution. And the kinds of data sources that you have, here are some examples from Facebook. Like you can have application databases, web server logs, event logs, API server logs, and so on. So these are a whole range of type of data that you can bring together and end up analyzing. Okay. So what essentially is a data? The most common representation essentially is that of a table. So you have essentially a collection of rows and columns. And each row has an index, and each column has an attribute name. And a cell essentially is basically indexed, obviously, by index name pair. So you essentially have a specification for the cell, which is the index comma name. And cell may or may not have a value. Sometimes it may be that it's not a number or empty. So it can be missing. So this is typically what you think in terms of as a data structure for data analysis. For example, here is an example of the Fortune 500 companies, the list of them and their ranks, and then here is basically different types of attributes. Where are they located? What is the state they were incorporated? What kind of revenues, profits, and so on. So each of these things are tables, which are numeric tables. And in fact, each of these entities could also be objects, for all you care. So it depends on actually the nature of the data. And if you talk about a file format, basically a CSV format, this is typically what it looks like. You have the name of the attributes and with a comma separator, and then actually the data itself. You can then load it in and then do analysis. And here is actually another example of a protein data bank, again, a table data set that illustrates in a different application. So now what is the challenge in actually taking such data sources and then doing analysis and drawing meaningful conclusions? The biggest problem that you have essentially is that you can have many missing fields. For example, some of the data sets may not produce all types of data. The device may go offline for a while. Device may be damaged permanently or intermittently. Timestamps usually critical but may not be accurate, so this is basically an issue. And other metadata, for example, location, device ID may have errors. So typically there are sources of errors that creep in, and these errors have to be taken into account while you do the analysis. And then, so here is, for example, a log file from Apache, which may be looking like this. And you can also do things like grabbing data from many machines, analyzing the profile of machines, and to understand, for example, what kind of events are happening. Do you have disk problems? Do you have network congestion, and so on, right? So essentially, so the main point that you have to understand is that two points. One is that data essentially is a particular table format, and it can have entries, which are maybe even objects, and you have an array. Effectively, it's a row times column structure. And then there are different types of formats here, and data can be an error. This is basically what you need to know. And of course, you can produce data, this data from files, and you know what a file is. And typically, the files are stored in a collection of pages or blocks, and you have a file system which is responsible for managing it, and you have operations which are opening, close, and so on. And you, depending upon actually the particular task of the application, you may have a whole range of different formats for the file. For instance, what kind of data model you want to do? Do you want to have a table, a hierarchical representation, or an array? What about the physical layout in memory? Because for efficiency reason, you want to maybe store things in a contiguous form. And then basically, what is the kind of metadata do you want to attach to the raw data? And do you want to use it in plain text or binary? And what about the encoding itself? Is it an ASCII or some other form? And what about delimiters, escaping? And what about compression and so on? And then how do you evolve actually the template structure that represents the data model, the schema? So these are all the questions that you normally have when you think about file formats or essentially data analysis. And you focus on performance in terms of how fast can you read and write, because that's very important. You want to get the data in and out very fast and then do analysis. So for instance, this is the package that is a very famous package for data analysis, which is a foundational package that everybody uses. And that's called Pandas, which essentially is optimized for that. And then you can also have the same thing in Java. You can see the difference in speed. This one is actually at least 6 or 7 times slower. then, similarly, in compression, you can also ask the question, how does the compression look like, and what is the read-write time for compression? And these are essentially, in the end, impact your speed at which you can do data analysis and reporting. Okay? So, from the programming perspective, what you want to take out from this lecture is actually that there's a whole library, and it's basically the documentation for this is about 500 pages or so, called Pandas, which essentially is a very powerful Python data analysis toolkit. And it essentially allows you, among others, to have two types of data structures. One is the notion of a time series, or an array of values, and a notion of a series of values. And you can think of it as a named and ordered dictionary. And essentially, it's built upon the NumPy package. And it's the n-dimensional array. And you can have any type of NumPy data type object. That's basically supported by Pandas. And it allows you to do slice and dice of the stuff, group, do all sorts of operations on this array data structure, and then be able to then do analysis. Then, on the other hand, in the data frame, it is also a notion of data frame where you have a table with named columns where you essentially, again, have a dictionary with a column name mapped to series. And each series object represents a column. Yeah. And there are functions, for example. You can apply specific functions on every entry. You can filter stuff on rows. And then you can sort and group. So things like what you do in Excel, for instance. But it's basically from the program itself. And it allows you to do a whole range of manipulation on Python level itself. And so this, I think, would be the what you need to do if you'd like to use a package in Python for data analysis. This is the one which is recommended. On top of this, you can put other machine learning software, which sits on top, like the scikit-learn, which allows you to do a whole range of data analysis. Okay? So that's really the workflow is more. You have NumPy arrays or NumPy data structures. You read stuff in, and then you can manipulate them using Pandas. And then after that, you can then feed that into scikit-learn, which is actually doing machine learning. So let's talk a little bit about the errors in data sources, what essentially that looks like. So from the point of view of errors in data sources, so this is the way a statistician views a notion of an error. This will take a little bit of explanation. I'll try to go slow. So from a statistician point of view, the way you think about it is that there is a data generation process. So there is an underlying process going on in the world, and that process is actually producing actually a particular kind of data. And this data essentially is coming from population. And this population, the variation in the population, could be due to many sources. For instance, it could be that during the process of actually measuring the data, you could have actually distortion. So in this case, the example, for example, I think I used the example in the image processing lecture, where you have a CCD camera, and you have a particular CCD element, and the actual intensity that's put out of the CCD element, the number, is actually a random number, meaning that even if I point the CCD camera at a particular location in a particular small patch, then I may have some random variation due to the amount of photons that's incident on the CCD that's varying. So in that sense, there is a stochastic process. There is a non-deterministic process that basically governs the amount of photons that's hitting. On top of it, this same CCD cell has particular properties. For example, it has particular thermal properties, particular collection properties of how much of the incoming photon is converted into voltage. And then there is actually the voltage conversion to digital. Okay. So in that sense, you have a sequence of transformations that's going on in the sensor. And there is randomness in the world itself, the measurement device itself, and the measurement process itself, along with actually the deterministic processing steps with some stochastic properties in the sensor that produce actually distortions. So that is actually what you talk about when you talk about they use the word dirty data in data science. I use the word noisy data in signal processing. And of course, the other thing is that selection bias. So let me explain what I mean by selection bias. So if I take a bunch of pictures, let's say in something like MySpace or something like Facebook, do you think those pictures that you have are actually reflecting the space of all possible pictures? And or is it actually very narrow view of what people typically capture? So typically people are staying at home, they want to show their friends something, take a snapshot of what they cooked or whatever. So there's particular kinds of scenarios, and those particular scenarios, they sample those scenarios, and then they get particular pictures that are put out. And so therefore, the nature of what you collect itself, in some sense, is biased here. Biased by the observer and the effect of the observer and the context. Therefore, you don't expect typically that the sample that you observe is actually coming from a very structured process, because you didn't have up front a good understanding of what you're going to do with the data. Therefore, you're just doing collection. Yeah? So in statistics terms, this means that this is actually a selection bias. There is actually some sort of bias in actually the process of actually gathering the data. Yeah? And and then also the left-right censorship. I don't know how many of you know about, for example, experiments and the trials where you start with actually a randomized experiment trial, and then you go through the experiment, and some patient either unfortunately dies or somebody discontinues the treatment. Therefore, you have some parts of the data which is missing. So that's called censoring. So, okay. So that's in statistical term essentially a particular type of a error or a particular type of a partial measurement. And then you have dependence of samples, okay? Because normally when you think about data collection, if I take a picture now here, and I tell you I'm going to take another picture in the next 1 minute, okay, it's likely that I'm not going to be walking away from this talk. I'm going to take a picture of, again, the same room. There is a correlation between what I did now and 1 minute later. Therefore, you have dependency, right? And if this dependency is not modeled, you essentially basically are... conclusions you draw may be different, right? So you see, this is basically the way you think about dirty data, right? Now, from a database point of view, if you think about database point of view, basically I got a data, hands on the data set, some of the values are missing, corrupted, and then results are absolute because it's relational, and you basically, if you improve the quality of the database, everything will be fine. That's kind of the view from a database person. Yeah, a statistician actually has a model of the process of which you got the data and tries to model it. Whereas a database person more thinks about it as, if you don't really do the modeling, You say, okay, I have a data. I try to make the quality as much as possible good, and then I have ways of treating some of the outliers. That's it. Yeah? And then the domain expert view, in the end, ultimately, if I'm actually, let's say, the weatherman or the weather prediction guy, and I'm looking at weather data, I bring to bear a whole range of experience from my past observations of this data. And I may have an implicit or an explicit model of the situation, in which case, I have actually a different way of looking at data. And I can already tell you, hey, for instance, oh, look, this is this. This particular thing doesn't add up. So I was just 2 weeks ago in a company in Humber Valley talking to them about data analysis, and then they just said the same thing. Oh, here is where we are trying to take data from outside, organize it, and then push it out into the for use. And sometimes, you know, the expert looks at it and says, that doesn't add up. I would like to know how to do that automatically. Yeah. So this is basically a way of thinking about, again, here, the experience of the person is in the intuition, certain types of correlation between different factors, which just doesn't add up. If things don't add up, then you say, hey, there's something wrong. So in the best sense, in the best scenario, what you would like to do is actually have a combination of all this. That is the best case scenario. That's why you think about bringing those three elements together. You know? That's the combination of computer science, mathematics, statistics, and domain knowledge. Yeah. So how do you, so essentially what I say is that, so it's clear that data has errors, and if you do transformations, as I was explaining in the CCD camera case, they can actually affect the data. And even if the data sets are clean, let's say there are multiple sources, when you bring them together, you may make errors. And you actually, rare errors can become frequent after transformation. And so essentially, you have a problem with the data quality. Yeah? Now, the main point, the message that you want to get from the last slide is that there is actually a process by which you're collecting data. And there is a random variation or statistical variation in the world itself. And then there is variation due to the way you process stuff. And if there are systematic errors there, that will creep in into the data sets. And therefore, whatever you observe as a data set has error. And now, if you have a good model of what the error is, then you can talk about what is the way in which the conclusions you draw can be, we can say whether it's meaningful or not. In fact, my own dissertation work is on performance modeling of these systems, where we think about errors propagating through these chains of modules and understanding how the system behaves as a function of choices you made and a function of the world model. Yeah. So in that sense, it's a statistical analysis work for systems analysis. And that's actually what you have to do if you want to have a data science workflow, which essentially can be used to rigorously certify that your analysis actually is correct. Yeah. Or at least, what situations can I trust that analysis? Yeah. Okay, so we talked about integrating and cleaning. Now here is an example of an outlier. What do you mean by an error? So, you know, here is actually an example of ages of employees, and suddenly look, these look reasonable. Suddenly you have a big number here, 450. It's very obvious that that looks like an outlier. So in statistics, this is called something which is not an outlier, which is not, there is inliers and outliers. Inlier means that it follows a typical distribution, a sample comes from the distribution, whereas the outlier is something far out. Yeah? And here is basically an illustration. For instance, this is actually this data, and if you fit a model, a Gaussian model, to all the data, including the outlier, what you get essentially is something like this, where the mean is actually shifted to the right, and then you see this thing is sort of very broad, right? So basically, you have actually a fat tail distribution, actually, in the sense. Basically, you have a larger variance. And obviously, this guy, one data point, has influenced the statistics of this fit, right? On the other hand, if I drop this thing and then I fit the model, I would probably get something like this, which is actually much more reasonable. So the question that you have to ask is, so how do I decide what an outlier is? Should I treat everything as outliers, or is the outlier actually something meaningful in a particular context? So let's take an example. Here is actually an example with ozone layer data. And in the 1976, people said, oh, actually, that is indeed potentially an opening up of the ozone layer. And what happened in that time is that they said, oh, OK, look, that looks like an outlier. Throw it out. Okay, so that shows you the kinds of mistakes you could make. Okay, when you I hope this thing is So you see that essentially you have to be careful about drawing conclusions with essentially these data sets. So sometimes it may be true that the process by which you have gathered the data and the instruments used and so on may have an error, and therefore you get these outliers. So you can have a bad pixel in a camera which suddenly is dark, and that pixel is bad and are consistently bad, while the other samples or other pixels are actually okay. So in this case, I can say, okay, I replace that pixel with some average of the values around it, which may be okay. But if that bad pixel, let's say somebody comes and sprays the camera with a spray can, is that actually an anomaly, or is that actually something that is a data error, an outlier, and throw it out? Okay. In this case, it's clearly an anomaly. It's got to be caught, and you have to actually appropriately change things. Right. So that's one of the key issues also in statistics, in terms of being able to know what essentially is the source of such an outlier. Right. So if you the typical problems in data integration. Here is a Stanford data integration course summary. There are problems that can happen in any one of these steps. For example, when you parse the text into fields, there are separator problems. You may make mistakes. Naming conventions, for example, somebody uses NYC for New York, whereas somebody else uses New York. Yeah? And this actually is the same thing, but it's just that they use different words or different letters. And then you may require a field may be missing, and somebody may use a number 2 versus somebody letter 2. Okay, so simple things, but they effectively change the nature of actually what you put in the data, and so you have to clean it up and process it to be able to harmonize it, right? And so there's a whole range of other things that you can look at. Again, this depends on the processing chain that you use. And what you really want is a good understanding of how to define data quality and how to think about a continuum of data. Yeah. And in fact, the kinds of data, the whole range of data you can get, we already talked about that. You can have federated data, descriptive data, and so on. And in fact, what's going on is that you really need to know the rules behind the data, and you need to understand how to interpret the data. And this is basically the main point. The point is that data information is not static. It flows in a data collection and usage process. That's exactly what I said. So you have a data gathering, data delivery, storage, integration. So you need to understand the process to be able to say what essentially the end data result looks like. So enough about data now. So what I have shown so far is lots of data available. You can draw conclusions from data. Sometimes you can draw wrong conclusions from data if you don't really carefully ask the question. And there are errors in data. And then we talked about data formats, in this case, the tables and essentially series, data frames in Panda. And then the last part of the section was more about these different views of how you think about errors in data. The statistician's view and the data's, let's say the database person's view, and also the viewpoint of the domain expert. So this is basically what we've done. Now I take the last 15, 20 minutes to just walk through data analysis problem, case study. So what am I going to do? So you've seen in the first lectures already that there is actually a lot of work in machine learning, image processing, and so on. And what I didn't talk about was what are the kinds of things you can do in machine learning. I don't know if I remember if I actually talked about two types of ways of doing learning. One is actually what's called supervised learning. The other one is what's called unsupervised learning. So in the supervision case, what you're doing is you say, here are my pictures, here is where the face is, and you crop a box around the face, and then you give the input. So then I have thousands of pictures with faces marked. Then I mean to build up a classifier that essentially recognizes face versus non-face. So that's the supervised problem. The unsupervised case essentially is I don't give you any of these labels, and then I actually give you a lot of data. You figure out what's common between the data, and you see if there is commonality and clusters in the data. So this is actually the two different worlds. Yeah? And in fact, in the supervised world, there are two types of problems. Typically, what people talk about is classification, where you're talking about a particular discrete label you want to put out, or you want to talk about regression. The regression essentially is basically that you have a y, which is the output, which is a continuous function of the input x. And that's typically could be linear regression, nonlinear regression, and so on. Okay. We'll talk about linear regression. So some examples of the supervised and unsupervised case. So supervised case is this image, a cat, dog, car, house. That's an example. How would the user score that restaurant? So it's like a mapping from a restaurant name to number. And then is this email spam? So you look at the whole text and you analyze it and say, ah, it's spam, or is it not? And is this blob a supernova? These are examples of supervised. Whereas unsupervised is where you have clustering the data. For example, you have 100-digit data, and you know that there's numbers from 0 to 9. I want to cluster them into 10 classes. And then now I have representative exemplars or examples which represent the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. And so on. Yeah. So let's just talk a little bit about regression, so to get a feel for what fitting is. And basically, machine learning is model fitting. In a sense, you're getting from data to models. And so here is an example. So here is actually the data. It's a one-dimensional problem, really. It's there's y, which is actually the response variable, which is a function of x. X is the measurement. X is basically the horizontal axis. And you got a scatter plot. From this, you got to fit the best fitting line in this case. Yeah. And this is actually a regression problem. This is always. This is the first time this happened. This is not that many slides. We're going to finish soon. Can you hear me, or is it bad? Okay. So here is an example. So here is basically my y, which is my the value that I want to predict. This actually you can think of it as a constant. In this case, some number, the mean of the point cloud here, plus some linear function of the x. And this actually, in general, x could be many variables, not just one. So here you see there are p variables, x's, and then there is the betas. The betas are the parameters. So you want to fit a linear model to actually the measurements, and then predict actually what the y is. Yeah? And this basically, the coefficient beta hat is called actually the regression model parameter. And if you assume the x naught as basically 1, you can then change this equation to say y hat is equal to summation j equals 0 to p, and then it becomes a matrix product. So you have a vector here, a value which is here, which is a matrix times a vector here. And the vector values essentially is your measurement values. So this is all each of these columns are nothing but the input features. And you can solve this problem. The way you solve this problem is that you actually define an error metric. In this case, you say, okay, after the fit, I want to actually have the sum of the difference between the predictions and the measurements, the observations, to basically have minimum error. So in that sense, you basically have a sum of square regression. And essentially, this translates to, in matrix terms, something like this, where you take the vector of predictions here minus the x beta, so in this case, the, this is the measurements, y, this is the, the x is the measurements, y essentially is the response stuff on the top, and then you essentially try to estimate beta. And you can take a, this is the actual symbolic representation of this. You can take the derivative of the stuff, and then you can show that the estimated parameters is solved by this equation, where you take the matrix of x's, and if you do this calculation, you get beta hat. Now, if x essentially is a large matrix, then you have a problem, because it's actually huge, and the computation will be a problem. So there are ways to avoid that by what's called gradient descent or stochastic gradient descent. And so essentially what you do is you start with a random location, a value for beta, and then you essentially compute the gradient or the direction in which you want to select, saying, okay, I have a I want to find a minimum point between in a valley, and then you start from somewhere and you keep going down and then walking down the direction of the steepest gradient, and then you go back to the bottom. And that's where the error, best answer is. And now, in a greedy fashion, if you do this, it's not necessarily optimum, but essentially there are ways to show that there are certain conditions under which you, that's enough to do. In fact, the neural network stuff that I showed you, the deep learning example I showed you, and the backpropagation algorithm that I showed you, is actually using stochastic gradient descent. So essentially, these are the same kind of ideas, essentially saying, okay, I have the data set, and then I'm trying to fit this model, and I start with an initial guess, and then I have a sequence of iterations that gives me back actually the point at which the model fits the data best. These are the parameters that are fitting the data best. So as I said, you could do this with what's called gradient descent, and you could do this with stochastic gradient descent, which essentially allows you to partition the data set and do this in batches, and then you have a learning rate, and then you can update it. And this is actually very standard now, you can get in any of the machine learning packages. And how do you know whether the fit that you got is correct or not? So the intuition for that is shown here. So for example, here is a data set, and then you fit this. This looks like a linear relationship. Is this linear? Not necessarily, because you can see this is like a parabolic shape. So it's more likely a quadratic or more higher order function. Here is an example of a case with an outlier. So you see, here are the samples that align with a line, but something essentially is mismatch, it's an outlier. And there are ways to go from what's called using robust statistics to be able to actually ignore these outliers and to fit actually the right function. Yeah. And here is another example where you really don't have much information along the x's, but you have values, more values for one x and another one, and the fit here is sort of you're guessing really. And how do you measure whether this fit is good or not? And there is a way to do that. This classic statistical way of doing it is what's called a hypothesis test. And the hypothesis test essentially checks whether this parameter beta that you had, remember in this case, you have x naught, which is 1, and then which is actually the mean value, represent the mean value, and a beta naught, and then there is actually the beta 1, which is actually the slope of the line. And so you can check whether the beta actually is 0 or not, the slope essentially is 0 or not. And so what you can do is you can actually take the predicted values, this is the observations, subtract them, square them, and then divide it by the sort of the variance measure, scatter measure, and then this number actually tells you whether the fit is good or not. And here is an illustration of why that makes sense. So here you see y bar is actually the mean of this particular cloud of points, and this is the actual least squares fit. Okay, and then for essentially each one of these points, I can measure actually a distance to the actually the fitted value, and that squared essentially will be here. Okay? And you sum it for all the points, and then you divide it by the total scatter, which is basically around the mean, which is basically for every point, you check how far it's from the mean. So you're just checking how far is it from this fit, is from something which is purely flat versus something that's sloped. Essentially, that's the main intuition. So if this number essentially is very small, this is fit is actually error is very small, then you essentially say, okay, r squared should be equal to 1, that is more likely a line which is has a non-zero slope. Yeah. And it's small, yeah, so this value is small if it's a good fit. So, and there is a way to map this particular expression to a more formal way of testing whether this actually number you got as null squared can be used to say whether the fit is good or not. I'm not going to go into that, that's a statistics argument. The main point is that you can map this number r squared to actual statistical distribution, and you can actually tell you with a particular probability that I'm confident that the answer is indeed going to be right. Yeah. So it's essentially the main, it's a classic statistics example. Now, what you have to be aware of in all this data analysis stuff is the notion of overfitting. So what do you mean by overfitting? So essentially, ideally, if you have large number of samples, you saw that example here, this picture. This one is clearly a case where the data is very sparse. It doesn't have a lot of information for all the other axes. Okay? And what kind of conclusions can you draw about values here? Okay? Clearly, the uncertainty in this area should be much more larger. Right? So now, if you have large number of samples, okay, you can essentially do a good job in fitting a complex model. Okay? And in fact, in reality, you only have a finite set of samples to train on. And so therefore, you need to understand how to trade off the model complexity. Because ultimately, if you get a data set, I can fit a complicated model through the data set and get you a zero error. For example, I can take a random collection of points, like in this case, this thing, and I can literally run through a curve through this thing, a zigzaggy curve, which goes like that. And that looks like a model with very high number of parameters. But that's useless, because it didn't tell me exactly the underlying structure of actually what's going on, or at least it doesn't give the essence of the data set. Yeah. So the point is that there's a trade-off between model complexity and essentially what essentially would be the generalization ability. So effectively what you're saying is that you can actually fit a very good model with more degrees of freedom in the model and get a training error which is very small. On the other hand, the problem is that when you have new data sets that come in, you can see that the error starts increasing as you increase the model degree of freedom. So the right model parameter, number of parameters, is somewhere here. So you don't want too simple a model, you don't want too complex a model, but something that trades off. Yeah. So the main point is that, by the way, there's one more major assumption in these analyses. The major assumption in these analyses is, I've seen a collection of data, whatever happens in the future, is the samples that I measure are reflecting the same underlying population that I've seen before. And if you don't, so without that assumption, you cannot do these things. Okay. So this is in statistics, it's called stationarity assumption, or basically the statistics are similar in the future. Whereas if you have non-stationary processes, then you have to know what essentially non-stationarity might be like. You have to model it. Yeah. So this is very important to understand. Yeah. And you can basically penalize, the one way to deal with actually this problem of overfitting is by actually penalizing for the model complexity by checking if the number of parameters in the model is higher, then make a penalty. And then you add to that extra, the error term that you had, extra regularizer, what they call regularizer, which allows you to then search for models which are balancing the two extremes. Okay? And the another way to actually check whether your models are correct or not is you take a huge data set. Sometimes the data set is small, in which case you need to do regularization. Sometimes the data essentially is you have a reasonable amount of data set. I can partition the data set into chunks. And then each of these chunks I can analyze separately and then check whether this fit that I observed from one carries over to the other. This way you can do cross-validation. Okay, so this is actually typically used in machine learning. So for example, what's the idea of k-fold cross-validation is you take the data, you break it into k equal size subsets, you run through these subsets and train the model, and then you test it on these models on the other data sets, and then you check, this is basically the variation that I have. And so here is an example. You take a data set, you split it up into training and test sets, and then you check, with this stuff left out, this is basically my fit on the stuff that is left out. And so you can see what the error is. In that sense, you say, in some sense you're saying, I don't use all the data up front. I just take only subset of data, and I do random subset of those data, and then I check again how well I can predict the unseen stuff. And that actually will give you a way of checking whether your data analysis could be good enough or not. Okay, so right on time. So in conclusion, I hope that the last four lectures gave you this picture. The main picture that I wanted to give you was, first of all, I wanted to give you the picture that it's an exciting time to study computer science. In fact, computer science linked with multiple disciplines. So it's basically quite a fun time. And there's a whole range of things that are happening in terms of sensors, computers, computing, networking, applied math, statistics, machine learning. All of these fields are merging in some sense. There's a common picture, and they're able to deliver complex IT systems, which are intelligent. And the questions of even making them intelligent as much as a human, this is basically the question that people are tackling. And the other point that I want to make is that this, of course, looks like it's more and more complex, but if you want to build complex things and you want to predict the behavior of complex things and certify them, you need to have a structured form of analyzing the work that you're doing, modeling the work that you're doing, and then certifying the results. And you want to have a structured form, an organization, for how people work together, collaborate, and make results. So I hope that this was essentially, in some sense, interesting for you. The main motivation that I had was not so much to say, hey, here's programming. I can teach you, Python and this and that and that. By the way, I can't be the expert in that. All the stuff, my students may be more of an expert than me on these pandas and other things. But on the other hand, I could give you the big picture of where this field is going and how it's shaped, and motivate you for essentially your future. Thank you very much.